I'm Julie Burstein in for Leonard Lope today on this rainy Monday afternoon. And we are listening right now to the Jimmy Heath Big Band. And this is from the album Turn Up the Heath. And Jimmy Heath is my next guest, a man of many talents, musician, composer, teacher, band leader. He's been acclaimed as one of jazz's finest saxophonists and one of the greatest arrangers of his generation. When you look at his selected discography, it reads like a who's who of jazz greats. He's recorded and played with everyone from Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis to his own big bands, as well as with his remarkable family, including his brothers Percy and Albert Tootie Heath. Jimmy Heath has just chronicled his life and music in a new book, I Walked with Giants, with Joseph McLaren, and it's from Temple University Press. I'm delighted that it brings Jimmy Heath to the Leonard Lope Show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Julie. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the things I loved in beginning your book was imagining your parents' house, because that's where you started rehearsing with your big bands. Can you describe what that living room was like with all of those musicians in it?
Chaos.
And how did your parents feel about this? Were they happy to have you come home with all of these people and make the walls shake?
Well, my pop was at work, auto mechanic, but my mom, and eventually she became a beautician. But when she was home, they loved the music, and they are the people who are responsible for me being into music, because we had all this music in our home. My mom being a member of a church choir, and my father playing the clarinet in the Quaker City Elks Band in Philadelphia.
There's a picture of both of them I read on the first album you made with your brothers, and it does seem like they had such a powerful influence on all three of you in terms of this passion for music.
Yeah, my older brother, Percy, played the violin in junior high, and that was a thing that was very fascinating, because his teacher was named Professor Pugsley. And Professor Pugsley had the longest pencil. And every time my brother Percy would make a mistake on the violin, he would get hit on his knuckles.
Oh,
so when my father asked me, he said, Jimmy, what instrument do you want to play? I said, not that violin, Pop.
Anything that guy doesn't teach, I'll play. So how about the saxophone, though? What drew you to that? Were you able to say, I want to play this?
Yes, I was, because I had heard Benny Carter and Johnny Hodges. Mm-hmm. Benny Carter is a great composer and saxophonist. He played multi-instruments. And Johnny Hodges was the sound of the alto from Duke Ellington's band. And then later I heard Charlie Parker. But so I told my father I wanted to play the alto saxophone, and he bought me one.
What was it like to start to learn? Was it something that you just took to, or, you know, it requires learning how to do a lot of different things that most of us don't do in everyday life?
Julie, the first thing I did as a young person, I was 13 or 14, I took the saxophone apart.
You took it apart?
Yeah, I took the keys up, but I was smart enough to not to take them all apart at once. I would take a key off and lay it down so I could figure where to put it back.
So why did you take it apart, though?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I was inquisitive.
Yeah. And trying to figure out how it worked.
Yeah.
That was smart, though, not to take it all apart and have all the pieces lined.
No, I would have never gotten, and still I wouldn't be able to put one back together.
Do you feel, though, by sort of taking it apart, it's almost like trying to find the soul of something, that you found something in it that then allowed you to really learn it?
Yes, I thought that, you know, and later on, when Charlie Parker played my instrument for a week, he borrowed it when he was playing in Philadelphia at the Downbeat Club. And he would leave it and go back to New York. He was commuting back because he was a drug addict, and he had to get back to New York. So when he would, I would be sure to stay there all night and take the horn back to my parents' cellar and take the horn out. He'd leave his mouthpiece. And I found out then that what goes in there just goes through, because I was... I would think, say, oh, Charlie Parker played my horn last night. I know some of that's in here, but it wasn't.
You know, you switched from alto horn to tenor. Was that part of it? Was that Charlie Parker, this was sort of the instrument that he owned in a way?
I think so. You have it. That's exactly what happened, because I had gotten the title from some of the musicians, my colleagues, saying that I was Little Bird. I was just like Charlie. Well, I wasn't just like, but I was trying to play like Charlie Parker. And a tenor, I figured I'd have a voice of my own. But all of us who played alto and switched to tenor, whatever Charlie Parker played, we played it on tenor, including Coltrane and myself and Benny Golson and people of my generation.
But you get at something really powerful, which is how, as a young musician, do you become yourself as opposed to following the people who you just look up to, like Benny Carter and Charlie Parker?
Well, I think it's a matter of application, dedication, and time. You can't do it overnight. It takes a long time to acquire the sound that you want. And after all, that play, the sound of music, is what's important. You have to have an individual sound, and that's hard to get. This takes time.
And was that true for you? When do you feel like you came into your own and said, this is the Jimmy Heath sound, this is not anybody else?
Well, that's debatable. Because it still influences in everyone.
Yeah.
We don't start
But
in a
stealing
vacuum.
Is what we all do anyway, so yes. That's part of becoming an artist in a way.
Yes, but when you steal something or borrow something, then it becomes your own, and you have to be able to make a variation on what you've stolen that would make it sound like your own. When you realize that 12 tones that we use in music, including symphonies and everything, over all these years, somebody still comes along and sounds an individual. That's amazing.
Well, that, and as a composer and an arranger, and listening, when I listen to your music, there's such a personality in that, too. And you get it, that's so interesting, that there are 12 tones. It's the same 12 tones for you
and
for Duke Ellington and Bach, yet you're able to. How did you learn that piece of your craft? When did you start arranging and putting this together?
Well, I was, Dizzy Gillespie was one of my main mentors. And he told me, if you're going to try to write music, you got to play the keyboard and learn how to play the piano. And I started playing the piano and learning harmonies and such. And then, being in a big band early in my life, I asked people, what was that note you played? What was that note you played? I liked the sound of that chord. And I would write it down, a very primitive way to learn writing. But eventually I began to write when I started recording. And then I decided to study with a man named Rudolf Schramm at Carnegie Hall. And he taught me how to take what I had intuitively learned and from my friends, they passed down ideas and things to me. I learned how to write extended compositions from him.
It sounds like, in a sense, you were feeling the music first and then figuring out what that language was to be able to translate what you were hearing from your friends into something that other people could play.
This is exactly right. You're exactly right. He was teaching, Professor Schramm was teaching at NYU, and he was teaching a system called the Schillinger system, which is a system of numbers. And Mr. Schillinger had said that all art could be attributed to numbers.
I had a math teacher who was telling me the same thing. I wasn't very convinced, though.
I'm not sure of that, Julie.
Yeah.
No, but anyway, there's some intuition. There's some other forms. And Schramm himself went back to what he called the Schramm system, which was traditional harmony, plus the Schillinger system, which helped. Gershwin studied Schillinger, too, and others. You know, but you use everything you learn, and you learn all your life.
And it's interesting let me reintroduce you before I ask this next question. I'm speaking with Jimmy Heath, the great jazz musician. And by the way, he'll be performing at the Blue Note from next Tuesday the 2nd through the 7th. And Bill Cosby will be the MC on the 2nd at the 10:30 show. And for ticket info, you can go to the Leonard Lopay show page at WNYC.org. And Jimmy Heath has just written a book called I Walked with Giants, Jimmy Heath and Joseph McLaren, and it's from Temple University Press. What I was going to ask you is something that I've always wondered about, which is, in a sense, writing the music down is a kind of translation already from what you hear in your head to what you then want people to play. And in the music that you write, too, there's room for people to interpret it their own ways. And when you started writing, did you write for individuals that you thought, all right, these are the guys I want in my band and this is the sound that I'm looking for? Or was it some other way of approaching it?
Not in the beginning. You know, that's what Duke Ellington and others who had steady orchestras. But, you know, we had to deal with who we could get at the time we were going to record in. So, but, you know, as Max Roach said, jazz is the most democratic music in the world. If you don't like jazz, you don't like democracy. Because
yes.
Everybody has a chance to speak their piece musically and say what they want to say. So the improvisational end of it is what makes this piece come all together, the creativity.
And in a sense, you create the space within which this conversation can happen
that
as the composer.
Correct. You sound like a musician.
I was at one point in my life, and I still love it. So it's lovely to get a chance to talk with you about
okay.
it. In your book, one of the things that I found really interesting was you talking about your time playing in Miles Davis's band and how you struggled with moving towards modal music with his mm-hmm. with his band. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between what you had been doing and what he was doing with modal music?
Well, he stepped into that. Probably, in 1958 or something like that. And after Coltrane left, I had played with Miles in 53, but having trouble and going away. When I came back and I joined him in 59, he was playing this different, and it doesn't have a final cadence in the modal music. It just kind of lays there. I was used to playing harmony like Jerome Kern's All the Things You Are or something that has a final cadence, and you get to the end and you know it's the end. And the modal thing left me hanging. It left Coltrane that way. He said, Miles said that when they were at the Apollo Theater, he had to blink the lights on Coltrane because he would go on. And he said, man, I couldn't find anything good to stop on.
It's so interesting because jazz itself, I mean, part of what you play with is that sense of uncertainty, that taking a line and stretching it out for the audience so we're listening to know when it's going to end because we don't know what's going to happen. But it sounds like with this, he didn't know either.
Well, but Julie, I think that in the usual compositions that end a certain way, people can follow it.
Yes, and they once you get towards the end, there's kind of a sense of, okay, it's about to stop now.
Yeah.
You're coming to a conclusion.
Yeah. At least, musical-minded people, some of the people who are today less musically in tune to what we do or Western classical, they just want to dance and they got this machine that has a beat.
In your book, and you just alluded to it a moment ago, you are really honest about serious trouble that you got into mm-hmm. also with drugs in the 1950s. And you write about a moment when John Coltrane almost overdosed with you. You say jazz history could have been entirely changed one night. What happened to you and to your colleagues that sort of led you down that road?
You know, it's a very strange thing that was happening. We were playing in taverns. And the people who came in, a lot of hustlers, and they always had drugs to offer you. And whatever reason you wanted to get these drugs or accepted them from these people, it was a serious problem during the bebop generation. And in my case, it was on a down from my girlfriend. I was engaged to be married, and she ran off with the piano player who I had gotten a gig with, Dizzy Gillespie. So I was kind of depressed, and I started. And I regretted that. But I think my salvation, as odd as it may seem, was 4.5 years in Lewisburg Penitentiary. And I said the day I got out, not again would I ever, and that was 1959, May 21st. And I've been clean ever since.
And your brother says in the book how, in a sense, your family was relieved when you were arrested and put in jail because it was a chance for you to get better.
Yeah, prodigal son returned.
May 21st had another anniversary for you, and that was the day that you met your wife, your future wife.
Well, that was the day that Percy and my brother Tootie had known a lady named Mona Brown, who I end up marrying February the 4th, which will be next week.
Congratulations.
We'll be married for 50 years, our golden anniversary.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. 50 years of music and family and, wow.
It is a blessing.
Your daughter is also quoted in the book. I don't remember the exact quote, but I think she said that your music really comes out of this strong sense of family. And 50 years together, that makes a lot of sense. Does it to you when you read what she had written, what she had said? Did that ring true?
Yes, it does. My daughter's a very smart young lady. And I think we had role models, which was wonderful. My mother and father stayed together over 50 years. My brother Percy and his wife, Percy passed in 2005, but he and his wife for over 50 years. My sister and two husbands stayed together 50 years. My brother Tootie has been with two different wives, but it's 40 years now.
Wow.
So my father and mother were role models for us. And that's not today. You know that. The world's so different.
What's also remarkable is you played music with your family, too. And we'll get into that in a minute. We've got to go to a break. I'm speaking with Jimmy Heath about his career in jazz. He's written I Walked with Giants, the autobiography of Jimmy Heath. It's published by Temple University Press, and we'll have more after a break. We're listening to Jimmy Heath, and that's a song called Like a Son. Jimmy Heath is here on the Leonard Lopez Show with me today. I'm Julie Burstein, because you've written a book about your life and experiences called Turn Up the Heath, and it's from Temple University Press. We were just listening to that marvelous solo on, I think, your piece Like a Son. And when I listen to it, I can hear the bass and the rhythm section playing something that's a little complicated, and then that solo is just extraordinary on top. How do you build that? How does that happen?
Incidentally, that solo is by my student.
Really?
Antonio Hart.
I'm sorry. I thought that was alto saxophone. So yeah.
And the book is entitled I Walk with Giants.
Yes.
The album is Turn Up the Heath.
Sorry about that. Yes, the book is I Walk with Giants.
Okay.
Yes.
But, you know, Antonio was such a great student at Queens College when I was a professor there. And he's such a nice young man and very respectful, never called me anything but Mr. Heath or Grandmaster. And in fact, Julie, you know, about that composition, I wrote it for him because he's like a son to me.
Oh, wow.
And now he's the professor at Queens in my stead. I helped get him appointed. He's the saxophone teacher there. And I played last night at Kennedy Center on a program called it's a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. And this was the first time that Antonio conducted the full big band. So I just left him last night. But the piece, I mean, it's written around his talent. So it's a complicated piece.
Well, the rhythm is complicated, and what the band is doing behind him is complicated and fascinating.
Yeah, well, you know, He came from Berkeley, and then he came to Queens to get his master's in jazz performance under my tutelage. And he learned to write, he can play, and now he's a professor. So he's just like a son to me. And that one has a different meaning to me than some of the other compositions, which Jim and I may be on that recording, and that's named after my daughter, who is a
Gemini.
A sign. You know, and I got a song called Gingerbread Boy that's for my son. Now, because we are interracially married, my wife and I, one of my friends said, when she was pregnant, say, oh, you're going to have a little gingerbread boy, a mixed kid like Mr. Obama.
Yeah.
So then I call that gingerbread. So it's different reasons for different titles.
Well, I noticed language is so important to you, too, as well as music. I love reading your titles and hearing about the nicknames you've given to people and your son has given to people. It seems like there's a playing both with music and with language in your family.
Well, I think that, yeah, it's a family trait. We improvise with language the same as we do with our instruments. And we call people by different names. You know, if Dazzling Dizzy... Well, Dizzy Gillespie was an outstanding trumpet player who could play some of the wildest ideas. So, consequently, you know, Oscar Speedyson, because Oscar Peterson was so fast.
Yeah.
But Count Basie left a lot of spaces in his playing. So that's why I have these unique names in the back of the book.
Is having a lot of fun, both with the music and the words, important to you? Is that a piece of what you bring to the music, is this idea of pleasure and play?
Well, I think it's about life, because music is life. And that's what my whole existence has been, music, since I was a kid and heard music. And I'm 83, and I'm still crazy about music.
I saw when I was researching you yesterday, I saw a YouTube clip of you with a bunch of players, and basically what you're mostly doing is laughing. You're telling stories and having such an amazing fun time. It's really quite wonderful to watch. And so I can see that is a piece of it, that it's the making the music and then also the having fun in between times.
Well, it's phenomenal to be able to do something you love and have fun at it while doing it.
As a teacher, because you taught for many years at Queens College, mm-hmm. have you found that things have changed in terms of the way people are approaching this music from the way you were as a kid growing up?
Well, I think from when I was growing up, we didn't have so many institutions for jazz in the colleges and everything like they have all over the world now. So it was a word-of-mouth thing. One person would hook up with another person and pass on what they had. It was mentor-teacher relationship.
Like you with
personal.
Dizzy learning how to play the piano.
Personal. Mm-hmm. It was a personal. Now, in a whole big classroom of people, the thing is you realize as a professor that there are going to be certain ones in that particular class that are going to really be great musicians, and the others will be great people, but they won't be the performers that other. So I always used to tell my students, I say, okay, don't make fun of the other person, because they may be the record company owner, not the performer, and you may go to them for a recording contract. Don't put anybody down because they don't solo as well as you. You have to be a human being and respect everybody's position. And a lot of people have studied under me, became something else.
Yeah, there's a part in the book from Ed Levine, who we mostly know as a food critic, but it sounds like studying with you was an important part of his development as a person, not just as a musician.
Ed was a great guy, and he took under his directions to try to enrich our career as the Heath brothers. And he wanted to play saxophone. He still got the saxophone, he said. He keeps it, but he put it back in the case, and he's the galloping gourmet or something now. My man, he's a wonderful person. And I've met a lot of people along the way. And I call him maybe a different kind of a giant, like my dentist who takes care of me, the dental giant.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of giants in this book that I've run across in my life.
Well, I have to say, reading your book, your wife seems like a giant, too.
Oh, we just got off the train. She went home from going to the Kennedy Center last night. But she is such a bright woman. She went to Rhode Island School of Design. She went to the University of Pennsylvania. She was most creative in her class, 1956 or something like art. She's a painter, you know, but she stopped and started painting children for me.
Two children.
Yeah. We have two beautiful children.
And a lot of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, too, it sounds like.
Yeah.
When you approach writing a piece of music, what comes first for you?
Different times, different things. But a melody is important to me. You know, there are three components. And that's the melody, harmony, and the rhythm. But now there seems to be one component. They talk and the rhythm. Okay, two.
And that's so compelling. I have two children, and I find themselves so drawn to that. And they listen to everything at home. But it's hard to compete with that sometimes.
Yeah. Well, it's because the media forces us to listen to it. But, you know, sometimes it's the melody first. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I go to the piano and find a great comfortable chord progression that I think would be comfortable to improvise on. And then I write a melody on it. So sometimes it's, you know, and sometimes it's intuitively, it comes, you know.
A melody just comes into your head.
Yeah.
Do you find you kind of noodle with it on the saxophone or the piano first, or is it in your head and you write it down?
I write it down, but then when I started at Queens College in 86 or 87, I bought a Mac.
Uh-huh.
So I write sketches, and then I put it in the computer. I found the computer with the programs they have is a great editing device. I always wondered, I say, Duke Ellington would bring in, Clark Terry told me, would bring in the arrangement, and you play it, and he didn't like it. He said, give me that back, and he'd tear it up. But now, when you got the computer, and you can play it back, you can fine-tune it before you give it to the... And then when they put the breath of life in it, it's so much better.
It must be extraordinary to hear it breathing that way.
True.
I'm speaking with Jimmy Heath. He's going to be performing at the Blue Note from next Tuesday the 2nd through the 7th. And he has just written a book, I Walked with Giants, and it's from Temple University Press. As you look back, do you find yourself being drawn to certain compositions from certain points in your life? Are there things that I know in Turn Up the Heath, there were some things from other points in your life that you put on the record.
Well, it's very difficult to get a recording with that many people.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did, and I'm continuing to do that now with pieces I play with smaller groups, I'm enlarging them and playing them with the big band. And, you know, coming up in the big band era, it was that is our symphony orchestra, Julie. We don't have, that's our largest ensemble, is the stage band, the big band, or the jazz ensemble like Lincoln Center, Wynton Marsalis. And that tradition is very strong in my history. And I like that. But I also play with a small group with my brother, Tootie, the surviving brother, the two of us, because Percy passed. And I have fun doing that, too. It's freer. But when I'm trying to conduct a band and watch everybody's notes if they make a bad note or whatever, and then when it comes to my solo, I may be in a fog. So it's more letting the other members of the band stretch out. And then I always like to play ballads, though. I'm going to play the love song.
Yes, and listening to the album, there's a ballad on there. I can't remember which one it is. That's just so beautiful.
I'm glad there's you.
I'm glad there's you, yes.
It's written by Jimmy Dorsey, the saxophonist.
Yeah, that and the way you play it is just so beautiful.
Thank you.
It almost seems like you can paint different kinds of pictures in a small group or in a big band. And some of your compositions on this particular album, they seemed almost cinematic. It was like you were telling a big story with this big orchestra.
Well, when you can do that, you're doing pretty good if you can tell a story and someone can receive and understand that story that you're trying to tell. Because, I mean, I think everybody, humans, have a love affair or something in their life. I mean, you don't have to say the same words over and over like they do in all the singers. They say the same words over and over. So we try to imitate the human voice with an instrument. That is what we work hardest on. And, excuse me, and in doing that, we have to learn how different inflections, how to play with different inflections, when to get loud, when to get soft, when to sustain a note, when to, you know.
When to break it, which also can give an extraordinary.
And when to bend it.
Mm-hmm.
If you can, a saxophone has the reed instrument, you say, and it sounds sad. You say, and it sounds happy. You're going ascending or descending.
And that sense of emotion, too, is so powerful, and music can get at it, I think, in a way that words sometimes can't, that music can elicit in a listener an emotion immediately just from exactly what you're talking about.
I wish you would tell people that.
That's what we're doing right here. Do you find with your students and with your own grandkids, I mean, are there ways, as you say, of communicating this, of saying, listen to this and listen for this. Here's how this will connect with you.
Well, you know, the kids are so inundated with the music, what they call music, going on today. It's hard to get them to listen to historic music, you know.
There are still some, though, who seem to really... In fact, my 14-year-old, I was listening to your music in preparation for this, and he was like, who is that? Mm. I said, that's Jimmy Heath. He said, we're studying jazz in school. That's really... And so the exposure in school, I think, primed him a little bit to be able to hear mm-hmm. this and be really pulled into it.
Yeah. Well, what I can say is that there's always someone that's going to be interested. That's our saving grace, that somebody's going to hear what we're doing and appreciate it.
And you seem to be doing as much as you can to get people involved, whether it's through books or writing or music or whatever you can do.
Well, this is my first experience in... I've written a couple music books of songs and stuff, but for writing about my life once only, this is the first and last.
We just have a moment, but it sounds like it was a challenging experience to do this.
It definitely was, and I'm looking forward to tonight.
Yes, tonight when you're at Barnes & Noble. Oh, yes, and I'll be mentioning that in a minute. Well, thank mm-hmm. you so much. It's just an honor to get a chance to talk with you and to listen to your music and to share your stories with all of these people.
I thank you very much.
I have one final question. What next for you?
More of the same.
Except not another book, it sounds like.
No, not another book, but more music. You know, I got stuff in the computers that hasn't ever been played yet.
Oh, I look forward to hearing it.
Okay, thank you very much, Julie.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Jimmy Heath, who has written a book, I Walked with Giants, Jimmy Heath with Joseph McLaren. It's from Temple University Press. And Jimmy Heath will be performing at the Blue Note from next Tuesday, the 2nd through the 7th. And Bill Cosby will be the MC on the 2nd at the 10:30 show. And for ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And he's going to be reading tonight at the Barnes & Noble, and I've lost my piece of paper that explains that. It's on the screen. Okay, 7:30 tonight at the Barnes & Noble opposite Lincoln Center. So thank you so much, Jimmy Heath.
Thank you very much, Julie.
On tomorrow's show, David E. Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, discusses President Obama's first year in office. Then journalist and biographer Alana Nash discusses Elvis Presley's complex relationship with women. Also, the TV show Glee has been a huge hit, and we'll talk to Brad Ellis, one of the show's stars. Plus, artist and filmmaker Hugues de Montalembert on his life since being blinded in an attack in 1978. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon, Stephanie Bernhard, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Julie Burstein, in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening.